Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we are very excited to welcome back to the podcast today, Brooklyn's own Greg Grandin. Greg is the Peter V. and C. Van Woodward Professor of History at Yale. And Greg, I'm just glad you're surviving over at Yale. I know how so many Yale professors really are most at-risk population in this country have been forced to leave. So thank you for joining us. And he's also the author of The New America, America, A New History of the New World, a sweeping history. I mean, congratulations. It's like really, really like one of those like big, awesome books, a sweeping history of essentially putting the history of Latin America in dialogue with North America and bringing them together. So Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. It's great to have a conversation with you.
Cool. Thank you so much. So why don't we just dive in and let's start where the book begins, which is with this conquest, this encounter with the world, the so-called first contact. And what you show is how this is really, obviously this is a moment, surprise, surprise, that has been studied at some length. But what you really show is how it reshaped Catholic thought in this really important internal way. So why don't we start there and talk about like, what was this encounter? What was going on in Catholicism? It's kind of funny, Greg. I was thinking as I read this, the arc of history might not bend towards justice, but it just does bend toward intellectual history. And so this is really a history to some degree of ideas, which I obviously really like. How does this reform how Catholics understand themselves in the world, this encounter, and led to this internal reformation that engenders this type of humanistic tradition that you're trying to uncover here and really center in this book?
Yeah, I mean, it is an intellectual history in many ways, an intellectual history. I mean, I've always tried to kind of, you know, not sequester one line of inquiry from another. I think about history in its totality and especially socializing intellectual history. But I set out to kind of answer a couple of questions, one that had long been, you know, kind of, you know, my obsession. One is the social democratic tradition in Latin America, how deep it is, you know, what it's rooted in, you know, first social democratic constitution is Mexico's constitution in 1917. The role of Latin America in laying the foundation for liberal internationalism, which is generally ignored by intellectual historians, by political theorists, by geopolitical strategists. And, you know, the more I tried to poke at those questions over the course of, you know, more than a decade, the further back I kept going and going and going and going. And, you know, it brought me back to the conquest and it brought me back to, you know, a fundamental kind of methodological question, the way humanization emerges out of dehumanization, right? That every document of barbarism also is a document of culture. And the extreme horror of the conquest. You know, certainly there were wars in Europe. Europe, at around the time of the conquest, you know, was one of the most bloody places on earth. But there was fighting among familiar peoples for the most part. The idea of that there existed a new world, and that it was quote unquote, discovered by the Catholic Church, the church which presumed to be the bearer of universal history. And all of a sudden it was in possession, you know, not all of a sudden, obviously, I'm foreshortening a lot of stuff. The conquest was a century long process, but all of a sudden they were in possession of what Bartolomé de las Casas imagined to be more people than existed in the old world. He was wrong about that, but they all accepted the fact that the new world was populated. The demographers think now it was about 100 million people. And what I look at is the kind of moral crisis that it generated by people like de las Casas within the Catholic Church, a crisis that was as consequential as the schism of that Luther brought about in the early 1500s, more or less concurrently with the conquest.
And I wanted to ask about that. Like, why? I mean, this is, I think Luther's 1517 and Cortez is 1519. I mean, like the two, the big moments. So,
yeah.
I mean, obviously you're not a medievalist, but like that is incredible that these happen at the same time. And so I'm curious, like, what is the type of open war? Like, it opens up Catholic thought in a way that was not possible in the late medieval period, even though there were changes. So why do you think that happened? Yeah.
Well, because Catholicism presumed to be universal, it presumed to be humanist, and it had this kind of humanistic thrust, and all of a sudden it was presiding over the worst human mortality event in history, according to some demographers. You know, within a century, 90% of those 100 million people were gone, you know, at first through conquest and war and dislocation and slavery and starvation, and then later by disease. And then, but you also had Christians who were troubled by this, who thought that this was a problem. You know, they felt that you couldn't, that Spain couldn't justify the conquest on the structures of medieval legal thought or Christian thought. You know, and at first, of course, was the papal donation that Jesus empowered the Pope, and the Pope gave America to Spain and Portugal, a little bit to Portugal. And out of these questionings emerge a kind of political modernism around fundamental questions, the question of political equality, de las Casas saying all humanity is one, arguing against slavery in all of its many forms, you know, gets.
But let's actually pause on him just for a second, sure. Because he's like one of the classic figures, yeah. Bartolomeo de la, like I assign him to my students. Yeah. He's the origin of everything, you know, anthropologists say he was the first anthropologist. So he's such a key figure in international thought, and I don't think enough people know who he is. So who was this guy, and how does this encounter with basically the brutality of conquest reshape his thinking to promote a new type of humanism, which you trace across the centuries, ultimately leading up to like Lula, you know, like de las Casas to Lula to some degree, right? There's like a key spine of humanism there. And so who was he, and what does he actually say?
Well, de las Casas was the son of a sailor merchant who actually sailed on with Columbus on a second voyage. He was born in Seville. He lived in Seville. He was raised. He was studious. He was a good Latinist. He had become a priest, a secular priest, meaning he wasn't associated with any particular order, even before he went to the New World. When his father came back with Columbus on his second voyage, he was given a slave as a friend, you know, a Taíno slave. He sailed to the New World in 1503, intending to basically be set up a kind of, a merchant shop with his father, and there's evidence that he actually participated in some of the battles of the early conquest. He goes back to Rome. He becomes officially ordained, and then returns back to Spanish America. And increasingly, he's troubled. He's actually given an encomienda, which is one of the many institutions. I mean, there are so many institutions and mechanisms by which the Spanish extracted labor and wealth from the Native American population. It makes your head spin. But the encomienda system was one of the main ones. So he was given an allotment of Indians. Then he participated in another battle, this time as a priest. and he was more troubled by what he saw, but he was still given a second encomienda of Indians, and he grew quite wealthy. But you know, a couple of years in, he describes his conversion not as witnessing the horrors of the conquest, although that obviously had to have been it, but by reading a passage in preparation and preparing a sermon, and a passage from scripture that said anybody who derived wealth from the labor of another human being, you know, is living in sin. And he gave up his encomiendas. And he became one of the most transcendental critics of the Spanish conquest. He's famous for writing a book that was translated, a small treatise that was part of a larger treatise that was translated into English. And so he has a lot of different, you know, vectors. The English pick him up as a critic of the Spaniards, and they use him to promote the Black Legend, right? That all of the horrors that De las Casas is describing is really just, you know, English propaganda to set themselves off. The English are good to the degree that the Spanish are bad. The English are modern to the degree that the Spanish are medieval. The English are tolerant to the degree that the Spanish are cruel. And they get a lot of that from De las Casas. But he's more than that. He was eclectic in his rhetoric, rhetorical strategy, and how he contested the Spanish conquest. But he contested it, you know, throughout the rest of his life, up to the point of modern political thought, where he began to argue that the conquest was illegitimate because it didn't have the consent of the people. But one of his most important contributions was insisting that there was no such thing as natural slavery, which was an early kind of justification for why Spain had the right to subdue and enslave Native Americans and then Africans. He argued that, you know, it makes no sense. If the majority of the world's population live in the New World, how can they possibly be the category of natural slaves? And this was a critique of Aristotle. And he's famous for a number of debates that happened within Spain, long 3-day debates in which he read from these tomes that he wrote in Latin, and
This was the era of debate. They'd like put the Talmud on trial, and you'd have to defend like the Talmud, you know.
And he could transfix everybody, and he could draw from medieval canon law, from the ancient philosophers, but then he was also a pioneer in testimony. You know, he said, I know these things happened because I saw them. Lo vi. He said it over and over again. I saw it. So, you know, his firsthand kind of testimony. And up until the day he died, he was, you know, he grew more radical in his, you know, I have a lot of stuff in the book. The whole first part of the book centers around Las Casas and dealing with the Spanish conquest. But he works out this strategy where he's going to use the sacrament of confession to reverse the conquest, you know, because of course the conquest is one big act of theft. And God said, thou shall not steal. So he started writing these guidebooks for how confessors should listen to the conquistador's last will and testament. And they were wickedly sharp belief that they could reverse the conquest in the sense that conquistadors, and many of them were repentant and they were fearful of where they got their riches. And so he sent out these guidebooks, mostly through Peru, that were enormously influential, and through Peru into a turmoil. And you know, the Spanish Empire spent a lot of time rooting out Las Casas' influence in establishing its authority. But yeah, he's key in a lot of this. But a lot of Dominicans and others were as well. You know, Francisco Vitoria never visited the New World, and he is one of the theorists of political sovereignty and international law. And one of the arguments is that, you know, one of the arguments of the book is that taken together, the Salamanca school, and that's what it's called because it was associated with the University of Salamanca, but people like De las Casas and Francisco Vitoria and others laid out an almost absolute, a very modern vision of political authority and legitimacy that affirmed the equality of people, that narrowed the criteria in which you could wage war down to a sliver, that insisted that all the world's nations had shared common interests, and that the foundation of international law should be in a recognition of that commonality, not endless warfare. And so what happens is that, and what I do in the book, and this is jumping around a little bit, is that the English and Northern European legal
Craig, let's get to that in a second.
All right,
I just have a couple of questions. we'll get to it. Don't you worry. Right. So I just want to pause on that moment for just to ask a couple of questions. And it's kind of orthogonal to what you do in the book, so if we could skip over them. First of all, do we know, obviously there's like a very powerful tradition of Catholic universalism and Catholic almost like a peace movement, and there's Franciscan. Do we know anything about indigenous influence on De Las Casas, and sort of like, is he reading? I mean, obviously not reading, but is he listening to like Nahua people and engaging with them? Because yes, obviously he was. I'm just curious if there's any sources there to that sort of like, obviously the sources are on the quote unquote Western side, right?
Yeah.
But I'm curious if there's anything done with the influence the other way, because obviously this guy was influenced by there. He was there so much, and as you said, he had an Indian slave since he was a child. So
no,
he's
well, but he was forced to give him Isabella. Oh, okay. Isabella took that slave back.
He had to give it away. Yeah, wild way. But is there like, do we know anything about the influence the other way, or are the sources just not there for that?
Well, the sources are not there, but my sense is that De Las Casas was not. There were a lot. I speak a little bit of Geronimo Mendieta, a Franciscan priest who is a generation after Las Casas, who also fights against the encomienda and is very humanist and utopian. And he sees in the simplicity of Native Americans the possibility of recreating a primitive church, you know, that here is our Reformation. You know, we don't need Luther's Reformation. We can shake off the corruptions of the Catholic Church by refounding the primitive church among Native Americans in Mexico. So, and he learned Nahua, he learned indigenous languages. My sense is Las Casas was not that. The sources aren't there, but my sense is Las Casas was a European, I have very little criticism of him in the book, but you know that he was driven by his own deep sense of the injustice of what was being done and the humanity. He saw the humanity of Native Americans, but I don't think he was influenced by their sense of what a just world
was. Yeah. Okay. And then my next question again is a bit historiographical, so everyone bear with me. So the other big literature to come out about the quote unquote new world in the last 10, 15 years has been examining it as crucial to the origins of capitalism. You have John Totino's book, Making a New World. And then beyond that, you have a bunch of writing centered essentially on 16th century Italy, which says that like Venice and all of these places that have generally been pointed to as the origins of modern capitalism were so engaged with products from the new world that the new world is actually the source of capitalism. So on one hand, you have this universalist humanistic tradition that you are very clearly tracing. But on the other hand, you have the origins of capitalism. I was just curious if you have any thoughts about the dialectic between those two things happening in the Western Hemisphere at this exact moment, or, I mean, the Totino book, for example, is coming for a lot of criticism, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just curious, again, orthogonal, but do you have any thoughts about that debate?
Yeah, I mean, I don't directly engage it, but it's certainly the book, my book is open to the, you know, to that premise that the relationship between, you know, capitalism as a universal economic system is the prerequisite for the emergence of a kind of universal sense of humanity and equality. You know, obviously I think that I guess on the Brenna versus Origi debate or the Brenna versus the Brundel. You know, I fall on the
Brenna versus Luxembourg. Everyone.
I mean, I do think, you know, it comes out of the Caribbean, the Mediterranean and you know, and the drive to the new world and extraction was central to the rise of capitalism, not the legal system of 14 counties in rural England. You know, that did away with the commons. I don't know. I mean,
right, because they're comparative universalisms, right? And this is why they become associated. Both of these ideas, that universalistic humanism, but also the universalistic capitalism, become associated with cosmopolitanism later on in history. So it just like struck me very much like there's these universal things being formed here with this encounter, because you have to include these people in your cosmology somehow. And then there's good ways to do it and there's bad ways to do it.
Yeah, and it's clear. And I mean, this is a little bit off point, but you know, one of the great things about writing this book is that is, you know, without making a strong argument, but just only more rhetorically, it's clear that the Spaniards understood that the source of value was labor. Like, you know, like labor created value. Without the labor of the Native Americans, without the labor of the Africans, there would be no colonial value and wealth. You know, it was, you know, there was no question about that. And, you know, that is related to the emergence of this humanism, because the Spanish Empire had to deal directly with the reality of the humanity that they presumed to rule over. They dealt with them and they organized them as extractors. They extracted the gold, silver. They extracted the wealth. They dived for the pearls. They worked in the fields. You know, so they organized all empire around organizing labor and organizing labor through a kind of hierarchy of racial difference, you know, Native Americans and Indians and Africans. So there was an open recognition of that. But then also Native Americans and Africans and African Americans were the center of the whole thing, not just as extractors, but as moral justification for the empire, right? So this for me is the foundation of social democracy, right? It's a universalism that recognizes difference. And then we could deal with this later on, but the Republicans who break away from the empire, they inherit this legacy in which they recognize they want to overcome the legacy of the colony, but it's a colony that bequeathed them a kind of universalism organized around difference. And that is what becomes social democracy. That's the argument. And in, you know, I don't know if you want to jump ahead, but that is not what happens with the English in North America, right?
That's what
Native Americans are not the main thing in the stories Puritans tell about themselves. They're, you know, I'll stop.
Yes. I mean, I think this is the next question, right? I mean, here comes the English to North America. They're obviously aware. They come out of a Protestant tradition rather than a Catholic tradition, obviously aware of what the Spanish have encountered, aware of the debates about, you know, the issues that you've already talked about. And it sounds like, I mean, in your book, it seems like there's some desire to do things differently, but really it just winds up, you know, not happening in the way that might have been envisioned in a humane way. So talk about what happens when the English get there and how, you know, how that story plays out.
Yeah, well, long before the English get there, the English are organizing themselves in the shadow of Spain, right? So, you know, this faction within English polity that are pro-Spanish, pro-Catholic, anti-Spanish, anti-Catholic, you know, they break with the Vatican, they go back with the Vatican, they're fighting the Irish are Catholic, you know, the Catholic and Irish are aligned with Spain. So there's already, as the conquest of the Americas are proceeding, England is kind of coalescing in the shadow of Spain, and they see Spain both as an antagonist. We talked about this, the famous black legend in which England contrasts itself to, but England also wants to be Spain. They want to be, you know, and paradoxically being Spain also means in their mind saving Native Americans from Spain. even as they're even, you know, so they're imagining flying to America to save Native Americans from the rapacious Catholic, you know, Inquisition, even as they're terrorizing and massacring the Irish, as the precursor. So in many, one of the innovative things the book does is, I think, is, you know, we all know that the reconquest of Iberia was the precursor to the conquest of America for Spain. I make a big deal of the conquest of Ireland as being an analog to the reconquest of Iberia. It sets up English in the United States. But more importantly, English theorists and you know, the managers of what becomes the colonial project in Jamestown and then later Plymouth, they're paying close attention to what the Spanish are debating. It's going on for a century. And there's a great document that I use in the book, you know, that the Virginia Company, they hold a debate in the early 1600s and they want to answer the question, should we put out some kind of document to justify and explain what we want to do in the Americas? And they just come out straight out and say it. They said, you know, the Spaniards have been the friars and the priests, and they've been debating this question for over a century, and they can't justify conquest, and they can't even justify slavery. It's better we don't say anything, because we don't want to get caught up in that debate. The evasion is built into the evasion and denial is built into the project. And then, of course, the social history of the way the English conquest plays out a century after Spain arrives. They arrive in, you know, North America. Epidemics have already, you know, wiped out most of the population. And so, you know, the Puritans get off the boat. It's like, look, where is it? You know, wow, God paved the way for us by sending the miraculous plague, the holy plague, the wonderful plague, they called it. And so I don't want to downplay the role that Native Americans played in early slavery and also then later the fur trade, but they weren't the scented thing for the Puritans. So, you know, to put in the most crude way, the solipsism of Puritan theology, in which they were so obsessed in all that crazy debates about predestination and whether they saved and whether they weren't saved and whether they could be saved if they did this or if they did that, and if a wolf attack was a sign of God's favor or as a test, or whether if the Indian, you know, was the same thing as whether the Indians attacked them. Indians are just kind of side players
in the wings of Puritan psychodrama that leads to the United States.
And it doesn't really change, right? So it's this constant evasion and denial of difference, and it creates a much different colonial experience. But I want to stress, you know, other people have done this in terms of intellectual history in different ways, but you know, it's how these ideas played out in relationship to the social history of conquest. So what I say, you know, I talk about how John Locke comes up with that, his understanding of property and, you know, mixing your labor with it and unused property. But well before John Locke came up with that, the Puritans on the ground had come up with their own justifications that were quite similar to the origins of private property and what it meant and what was legitimate property. It was based on the idea of emptiness, of discovery, of vacant land. And that wasn't the case for Spanish America. And that's a big distinction.
So what do you think your major contribution to this comparative colonialism debate, which has been going on for centuries, and then how does the presence of the English shape the social democratic strand of thought that you're tracing through De las Casas and others, the Salamanca school?
Well, I think, one is I do try to root all of this intellectual history, you know, I would try to socialize intellectual history and root it in the social history of conquest and think of the comparative colonial projects as an ideological contestation. And as I say in the introduction, as a kind of imminent critique in which, especially, you know, it's different understandings of Christianity. It's different understandings of what it means to be American. It's different. Then it becomes different understandings of what republicanism is. It's, you know, these aren't epistemic others that are fighting against each other. You know, they're fighting over the meaning of a shared set of terms. And so I try to trace that out. It's different because then I also bring it up to Latin America, to how this shapes, you know, social democratic modernity and liberal internationalism, which we can get to later. My focus on how Republican, Spanish American Republicans who lead the break from Spain, understand themselves as atoning for the conquest, right? As opposed to, you know, U.S., the Republicans who led the break from Great Britain thought they were fulfilling the promise of settlement. You know, those are two very different settler colonial projects, right? And they lead to all sorts. Some reviewers think that I romanticize Catholic, I'm rehabilitating Catholicism, romanticizing the Spanish.
Someone's got to do it.
And letting Latin American leftists off the hook. But the whole point is to show how the hypocrisy and the disjunction between the reality and the ideal creates these new ways of thinking and creates new possibilities and to understand the difference. So Latin American Republicans, they're much more attuned to the reality of social obligation, right? So for instance, where in the United States, a certain kind of individuality can be celebrated and written into its foundational documents. In Spanish America, there's an awareness that, you know, they draw on critiques like Bartolomé de las Casas that the problem with the conquest is that these conquistadores, it wasn't the Native Americans that were not human and deserved to be put down. It was the conquistadores that, by leaving society, by breaking free of all moral restraint, you know, set themselves on Native Americans as if they were wild animals, as if they were tigers, as if they were jackals. And, you know, it's a kind of individualism stripped of all moral authority, of all social constraint. That was the horror of the conquest. And in the early constitutions, you know, centuries later, it's clear that they're already grappling. You know, it's a classic kind of Republican grappling with, you know, in the individual rights, but a kind of, you know, how do you balance that with the larger social good? And you know, the very first constitution in Latin America was in Venezuela in the 1811, 1812. And they're clear. They have a whole set of individual rights. You know, you have the right, you know, private property is a right, the freedom of assembly, freedom of belief. These are all individual rights that are granted by God and individuals possess, but they explicitly say there's no such thing as an individual without society, you know, and they use the word social 9 times. They use the word society 13 times. I mean, don't hold me to that. Something like that. I mean, something like that, you know, the word social society doesn't appear once in the U.S. Constitution. So it's that kind of tension that I'm kind of getting at.
So then here's a big question, which I think is definitely, I know, has been asked before, which is the United States have this to bother also perhaps Andrew Stevenson's concepts of cellular replication in the colonies, that they have this notion that the people outside could then join in. But of course, there is no United States of Latin America or South America or Central America. So then you have this like incredible stress on individualism in the United States, but there's this notion of like, we're going to bring the outside in, and you have this sense of sociality in Latin America, but there's not a united group of republics. Is that a problem, or like why don't they have the, you know, the continental vision of coming together, or is there a universalistic vision?
Well, they do. I mean, I look at it a little bit different. So, you know, the United States is founded as a single republic on what they imagine to be an empty or empty enough continent. I mean, obviously it's not. There's the Creeks and the Chacoteau and the Native Americans and the Spaniards and then the Mexicans and, you know, and but they imagine that they're alone in the world. Latin America comes into being already a League of Nations, already a United Nations, seven independent republic plus Brazil, which is independent but has this weird monarchy thing. And they have to, on a continent that they say is already filled up, you know, and of course, it's not really filled up, just like America wasn't really empty. I mean, there was large chunks of South America that was out of administrative control of either the empire or the new republics. But they imagined it. They imagined there was no space that was not already social. And they explicitly, you know, the United States came up with a theory of sovereignty that rehabilitated the doctrine of conquest. You know, and the U.S. was law professors were teaching the doctrine of conquest as legitimate up until the 1920s in the United States. And it was reaffirmed by the Supreme Court. And as the United States moved west, it wasn't cellular reproduction. It was Indian removal and wars against Mexico and wars against the Seminoles and two bloody wars against the Seminoles to establish control over Florida and yes, there was this.
All those Florida's nuts. For people who don't know it, like there's all these private expeditions, filibusters that like go in there. Yeah. It's wild.
And it's like the last war of the War of 1812 because it's Andrew Jackson goes in there to put down the Creeks who were trying to get their land back that was taken that he took from them in the War of 1812 in Alabama. You know, I go into all of that, but you know, the United States rehabilitates the doctrine of conquest, the doctrine of war. Now, Latin America can't do that, right? Like Latin America has two models of sovereignty. One is the United States and the legitimacy of the doctrine of conquest. The other is balance of power Europe and the post-Napoleonic settlement. And Bolivar, and they don't like that. They think that any kind of, and it's this is certainly, you know, apropos of today, that balance of power, what we call realpolitik, is fundamentally unstable. Each nation pushing against each other with the premise that competition and dominance is the way to go. Each pursuing their own interests will always lead to war. You know, one nation will push too hard, be some upstart like Napoleon or Netanyahu will throw the whole thing over, you know, topple the whole thing over. So they rejected that, and they certainly rejected the United States' theory of conquest because they had to, right? Like, what if Argentina said, you know, we'd like to get to the Pacific too? You know, like what, you know, what are they going to do? Treat Chile like the United States treated Mexico? They're not going to do that. I mean, both for normative reasons, a sense, you know, sense that they were all sister republics that broke free of Spanish America. So Spanish American republics come into being both threatening and legitimating each other. Threatening in the sense that under the old terms of international law, there's nothing to stop Argentina from invading Chile and taking it and saying, you know, we got it. You know, as you possess, so shall you possess. But they legitimate because they both show that it's legitimate for republics to break free of the Catholic Empire and establish their independence. So they come up with a new way of thinking, and it's Bolivar and it's his foreign minister, Pedro Gal, who dust off this old Roman law doctrine, ute posseditis, as you possess, so shall you possess. And it was originally a doctrine of war, a doctrine of conquest, you know, when you got to keep what you took in the last war. But Latin Americans turned it into a doctrine of peace. They say, look, we might not like colonialism, but they left us a series of vice-regal borders that we more or less should respect. I mean, Bolivar and Francisco Miranda and Pedro Agana in Chile, they all wanted a greater America. They did want to come together, but, you know, there were too many interests and divisions, and there was no social base for that kind of unity in many different ways. So Bolivar accepted the fact that there would be multiple republics, but the idea was to get to some kind of universal America. But anyway, we have to take the borders as they are. And this becomes this ultimately is the foundation for the rejection of the doctrine of conquest, the rejection of aggressive war, pretty much all of the principles that will later be found in the United Nations and the League of Nations come out of this moment. And that's the argument. One of the arguments.
So just to clarify for myself, so you basically, the reason that there is no sort of like greater America like Bolivar himself imagined is because of just the literal social realities of the different republics who were by the early 19th century too different to unite them in a way, like a much more inchoate United States at that same moment.
Yeah.
And so it's not really linked to the different intellectual traditions, a sort of proto-social democratic tradition and the, you know, proto-liberal capitalist tradition.
No, the social base. I mean, look, a lot of Latin American republics appreciated the United States. They looked in awe at the way it was growing, at the way its economy was growing, at the wealth it was accumulating, and they wished they had, you know, a country in which that they found a government in which letting loose the pursuit of individual interests would create virtue, you know, but they knew they didn't have it. They knew what they had was the remnants of a 3-century-old empire that had created so many different categories of racial definition, from the original Indios and Españoles to like hundreds of different categories. They, you know, presided over by, you know, a patrimonial, manorial, landed class that a status hierarchy in which race and blood still mattered, even if Republicans declared that it didn't. You know, there was attachments to their local patriachicas, their local countries. You know, some countries were adamant about abolishing slavery immediately. Peru and others were like, you know, we're going to go a little slow with this, you know. But it is interesting, right? That there was no civil war was needed to end slavery in Spanish America, which is interesting. There was the assumption that independence would lead to emancipation, even if it took longer in some countries than others. But that's another question. But
well,
no,
I mean, and the civil war is ultimately, I think, the product of expansion.
Yeah.
Right. Like, yeah, problem of expansion, yeah, ultimately engendered the civil war. Yes.
Yeah. 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 But to go back to the question of, you know, why there's all these independent, you know, Bolivar, as it, you know, it was nearly a 2-decade civil war of independence, and Bolivar faced, you know, these revolts in which, you know, I talk about one, Boves, he's this weird royalist, cowboy that wages this class war against, you know, all Spaniards, even as he's fighting to put down the Republic. And, you know, and so there's ways in race and class and status mix in all confusing ways because of the universalism, because of the immediate sense that we are going to do away with all of these caste categories and everybody's going to be a citizen. That in many ways, you know, I'm not blaming the chaos on that, but you know, it did unleash a degree of anarchy that was hard to organize, and certainly impossible to organize as a great, you know, individual nation called America, even though that's what a number of independence leaders imagined that they would get to. Next.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Let's talk about the reaction in the United States as people are observing Latin America, the Latin American Wars of Independence, the eventual independence of these countries. the debate that goes on. You talk about it in the book. You know, Henry Clay, for example, is proposing that these countries could be partners in the American system. And then you get the response from John Quincy Adams that, no, we have an American system. It's the United States. We don't need, yeah. And this all obviously leads up to the Monroe Doctrine and the promulgation of that. So let's talk first about the debate and then the doctrine itself and how it was intended by the U.S. and how it was received in Latin America. Because it sounds, I mean, you know, the way you described in the book, received positively, it sounds like, in Latin America, even though, you know, it's like, be careful what you wish for, I guess, the monkey's paw curled. But yeah,
The Monroe Doctrine is great because, it, you know, obviously it's five non-contiguous paragraphs in the State of the Union address, you know, and, you know, that's not delivered, that's read. I guess, or delivered, I don't know, you know, isn't it just a message that they sent to Congress, I think, at that time? And you know, there's the, you know, Latin Americans liked the anti-colonial thrust of what they saw in the Monroe Doctrine, that, you know, that no region that has established independence that has been recognized by the United States can be recolonized. You know, the United States wasn't going to contest, you know, British Guyana. They weren't going to contest, you know, Spain's hold on Cuba or Spain's hold on Puerto Rico. But they said that, you know, Mexico was free, Chile was free, Colombia was free and can't be reconquered. And that wasn't, you know, that was inspired. I mean, Bolivar at that point was thinking, you know, he would have to ally with Great Britain in order to finally beat Spain. He was thought he'd have to submit to Great Britain, but it was celebrated in Latin America. But there were other parts of what becomes the Monroe Doctrine that were, you know, that were less anti-colonial, that imagined what we would call a mandate for informal imperialism, for informal colonialism, in which the United States claimed a right to respond to any threat that it deemed to get, any threat within the hemisphere that it deemed against its interests, the United States had a right to respond. And that becomes what we think of as the Monroe Doctrine over the decades, especially as the United States does. So when Mexico is begging the United States to live up to the Monroe Doctrine and break up a Spanish effort to reconquer Mexico, and Spain doesn't launch that effort, but you know, the United States, you know, Monroe says, well, we're not going to do that. And, you know, you know, there's lots of, you know, like, there's numerous appeals by different Spanish American countries and Brazil for the United States to execute the Monroe Doctrine when they're under threat by Europe. And the United States, of course, doesn't do that. But the Monroe Doctrine, the other thing about the Monroe Doctrine is that it's the great reconciler, right? It reconciles these various tendencies within U.S. foreign policy establishment, these fledgling, you know, I don't want to call it isolationist, because we all know that there's no such thing as an isolationist tradition, but you know what I mean, or unilateralist, the internationalism of Clay, the idealism of Jefferson, the unilateralism of John Quincy Adams. The Monroe Doctrine kind of reconciles that. And that becomes an argument throughout the book, that Latin America is the place where different ideological and potentially conflicting tendencies get reconciled. And the Monroe Doctrine is the first example of that, you know, in which they all come together, you know, Jefferson and Monroe and Clay and Adams and Calhoun. And it all kind of, you know, they all read the Monroe Doctrine for what they think it means. And that kind of a quicksilver elusiveness runs throughout the 20th century. Woodrow Wilson, you know, we can get to that later on, but he does say, you know, he's on the stump trying to pitch the League of Nations to the U.S. public. And he said, you know, every time I read the Monroe Doctrine, its meaning escapes me. I can't quite define what it means. It either means, you know, an anti-colonial world of democracy, or it means the United States gets to go into Latin America whenever it wants and you know, and exercise its will.
And Wilson certainly himself does that quite a bit.
Yeah.
So the two big events, I think, of the late 1820s are, of course, the Panama Congress, which I believe occurs in 1826, and then Bolivar himself dies in 1830. So what are the significant moments? Correct me if I'm wrong, but the U.S. was going to send delegates to the Panama Congress, but eventually didn't. Like, one died, and then yeah, another, like, it was like a very strange story. Yeah. And one died and the other like doesn't go.
And one got too late.
Right, too late. Okay. So what is this Congress? Because I think it's actually crucial in this sort of hemispheric story and not everyone knows about it. Yeah.
So this is the Panama Congress is a Congress it failed spectacularly but had enormous consequences. It was Bolivar and Pedro Gall and other internationalists' attempt to lay down the foundations of what they imagined would be eventually become a unified republicanism, a world republicanism, and in this more fantastical utopian moments, Bolivar imagined Panama as being the seat of a world government, malarial Panama being what is ancient Greece compared to Panama in the future, Specifically, though, it meant to affirm a number of principles that that sectors of the United States' political class, wouldn't find particularly welcome. One was calling for the abolition of slavery. Two was affirming, the anti-colonial interpretation of the Monroe Doctrine. They were going to affirm the Monroe Doctrine, but the anti-colonial interpretation of Monroe Doctrine. They were going to affirm ute posseditis, and they were going to, figure out ways to free Cuba and Puerto Rico from Spanish rule. And Bolivar spent, and all of the kind of Spanish American internationalists that imagine America being bigger than the sum of its parts want this to succeed, but it's a dismal failure for a number of reasons. But what's more important about it is the reaction in the United States. So John Quincy Adams is the president, and he lets slip in his message to Congress that he's going to send a couple of delegates to Panama. And, this sets off months of debate. John Calhoun is his vice president. He presides over he's presiding over Congress. He becomes much more of up until that moment, the head of the Senate was a kind of a figurehead. He played a much more active role in organizing opposition to his own president's plan. You begin to see what becomes the Jacksonian coalition come together. Jackson is, back in Tennessee at the Hermitage on his plantation, on his slave plantation, watching the whole thing. He's the man in waiting, the man in the wings. But you begin to see all of the different factions that become the Jacksonian coalition come together in opposition to this idea. And you also see, three things happen. One is an increasing racialization of Latin America, particularly by Southern senators who are, the idea of like sitting down, John Randolph, a senator from Virginia, thinks that Guatemala is mostly Africans. I don't know where he gets the idea, but the idea of sitting at a diplomatic table with people from Africa and like, what are we supposed to? And then he starts complaining about the social balls that they'll have to go to. So this whole idea of Spanish America as this racialized place. Two, another thing that you see in these debates and something that will run throughout U.S. diplomatic history is a refusal to let international treaties be used as a tool to reform domestic affairs, right? The fear that, like, if we sign a treaty, we'll have to abolish slavery. The fear that if we sign a treaty, we'll have to end segregation in the South.
Yeah, the fear that if we join the League of Nations, they'll all of us.
Yeah. The idea that foreign policy will be the back door through the idea that internationalism will be the route through which progressives will get their agenda. Like that's here, because Adams imagined a very robust state. And in this message in which he said, oh, by the way, I'm sending two delegates to Panama, he laid out a very robust vision of canals and roadworks and postal routes and, you know, and astronomy observatories and all of this stuff. And so the reaction to that was of course the rise of state rights and a minimal government, because the fear that a strong federal government would impinge on the right of slave owners and settlers, right? So the backlash to the Panama Congress calls into being the Jacksonian coalition. And long before Latin America attaches the adjective Latin to America, Anglo-Saxonism defines itself, a Saxon America defines itself against Spanish America or South America.
Yeah, it's almost perfect because you have the Southerners who are losing material power within the United States. The 1820s is really the shift where, like, oh, Northern manufacturers are going to kind of dominate the slaveocracy of the South, so they could be mad at it. And then the Northerners are mad about, like, they want to step onto the world stage like the United Kingdom, so they could be mad about it. And so there's a lot of things there.
Yeah.
So we want to wrap up. I think we're at a point to sort of ask a concluding question. And what better way to conclude than with the Mexican-American War when this all becomes a shooting contest? Talk about the processes that get us to this place. The ever-expanding push across the continent eventually runs into territory that is ostensibly part of another nation. I mean, all of this territory is part of other nations, but one that is ostensibly recognized by the United States, Mexico. You wind up settlers moving into Texas. This becomes an issue, and then, of course, erupts into war. So what happens here, and what are the implications for the relationship between the U.S. And Latin America?
Yeah, well, I mean, it actually starts even earlier with Spain, right? Spain is the United States' first western border at the Mississippi River. And Spain, who was very active in supporting the American Revolution, because the King of France was a Bourbon, convinced the King of Spain, who was a Bourbon, that they had to join forces against George. And Spain was instrumental in I mean, obviously, there's a lot of variables about why the British colonialists defeated the royalist forces, but Spain basically kept the British busy on the Mississippi River. They fought a battle in Nicaragua that denied Central American hardwood to the Jamaican shipyards. They were, you know, they fought in Pensacola. And as soon as the United States won, Spain realized that they had made an enormous mistake. You know, and then now all of a sudden they boarded an aggrandizing nation that was, you know, insatiable in its desire for land, that it was moving forward. So Spain immediately puts into place a containment policy that was contradictory in all the wonderful ways Spain was. It encouraged settlers to come in, the ones that went into northern Mexico, and bring your slaves. And the more slaves you bring, the more land you can. At the same time, they told slaves, flee your masters, come across the border. We're a sanctuary empire. And so there's all sorts of contradictory actions in which Spain took to try to contain the United States, including giving Andrew Jackson subjecthood, not citizenship, but Andrew Jackson went down the Mississippi before, you know, around the time that the U.S. Constitution was being ratified, and, you know, because he wanted access to the Caribbean, and he became a Catholic Spanish subject. He swore on a Roman Catholic Bible. So, you know, long before Donald Trump, you know, one, you know, sold his soul to Russia or whatever he did. We had Andrew Jackson as a Spanish Catholic subject. And so what does Spain do? Spain says, you know what? We're going to sell Louisiana to France because we can't deal with the United States. And we're going to hunker down behind the Savin River and the Red River, you know, basically. And then, of course, what does France do? France then immediately sells Louisiana back to the United States. And Spain is once again, there's the United States. And and there's no getting away from it. And this, you know, this kind of continues. And then at the same time, there's the, you know, Wars of Independence. Mexico becomes an independent state. And it's the same process, you know, United States pushing and pushing refugees from, you know, early and not formal Indian removal, but already dispossessed Native Americans are fleeing the Mississippi Valley into Mexico. Escaped slaves are coming in, revolutionaries and people, you know, gun merchants are all coming down the Royal Road into Mexico, into what is Texas and the, you know, and then other parts of northern Mexico. And there's a sense that, that it's not, you know, that it's not stoppable. You know, Mexico becomes essentially a slave state in all but name, because, you know, the settlers that had made the deal with Spain in the last years of its rule had grown in number, and they launched their revolt against Mexico in 1835, and you know, there are many causes, but Mexico's attempt to enforce abolition and emancipation was one of the main ones. And then, of course, you know, the United States wanted to get to the Pacific, and so the same year they annexed Texas, they ginned up a pretext for invading Mexico. And the Mexican War was much longer and drawn out than they thought it would be. You know, the Second Seminole War in Florida was also a quagmire, and it was enervating, and it dragged down the morale of the U.S. military, and it created a kind of sense of malaise among the American public that they get to defeat these Seminoles. It was the first Vietnam syndrome, and going into Mexico was supposed to kick the Seminoles syndrome, right? We're supposed to get over that, and it turns out the Mexicans put up much longer of a fight than they thought. It went on for 2 years, but eventually the United States did occupy Mexico City,
And also, just very quickly, this is the war that basically sets the stage for the Civil War, because yeah. all those guys get their first battle experience. Yeah, Robert E. Lee is there. Ulysses yeah. S. Grant, they're literally all there with Winfield Scott marching on Mexico.
Winfield Scott, yeah. Grant, Lee, they're all there on both sides. It becomes a training ground. There's even a book, The Training Ground. It's about the Mexican War as a training ground. It also happens, you know, at the same time that in Europe is having its summer of season of revolution in 1848, in which the social question is thrust into what liberalism is and what a liberal state is, where they're going to have to deal and it begins the socialization of liberalism and the rise of labor parties and the rise of labor. All of those revolutions are defeated.
Yeah, the manifesto, the communist manifesto.
All of those revolutions are defeated, but it does force the social question into the public realm like never before. The United States, what American study folk calls the American 1848, isn't a social revolution, but a war on the frontier against Native Americans and against Mexicans. And it's this war against Mexico that Anglo-Saxonism really develops its kind of supremacist edge, you know. And Anglo-Saxonism, the ideology of Anglo-Saxonism has a number of roots. The Transcendentalists, you know, Emerson was an Anglo-Saxonist and Jefferson was an Anglo-Saxonist. But it's war against Mexico that the term Anglo-Saxon really enters into. Somebody did a study, and after Texas, really is when Anglo-Saxon becomes an ideology of war and an ideology of spreading out through Mexico, if not all of the Americas, at least until the Darien Gap. They often talk about, you know, from Canada to the Darien Gap will be the homeland of the Anglo-Saxons. So it really,
and of course, it's very ironically this is the moment of German immigration.
Gross. Oh no.
I'll come back in a second, but I just wanted to say that this is of course the moment of high German immigration to the United States.
Yeah.
When Anglo-Saxonism, of course, begins to take off as an ideology. There's yeah. ironies of all this stuff.
Yeah, right. I know. And Anglo-Saxonism has its imagined roots in the German far and the Black far, the Teutons and the Saxons and the free men who come out and
Teutons. They love the Teutons. They can't stop talking about the fucking
but
Teutons.
But it's really it's really war, the Texas war against Mexico and then the U.S. war against Mexico, in which Anglo-Saxonism becomes really a kind of, you know, racialized to the degree that we understand it, racialized against Mexicans and against Spanish American, right? They're, you know, the slavers don't like the arrogance of Spanish American Republicans saying that they're that republicanism means emancipation for all and citizenship for all. Settlers want Mexican land and all of the, I mean, the you know, and it was a war of volunteers. It was a settlers' war in which, you know, the volunteers from Tennessee and from, you know, these southern states and these western states were brutal against the Catholics. It was a civilizational war, Protestantism against Catholicism. We see a lot of pushback when, you know, the Irish Brigade, the St. Patrick Brigade that fights on the side of Mexico, but the desecration of Catholic cemeteries, the desecration of Catholic churches in Mexico. So it really is a kind of hard-edged, racialized war that, and then of course, all of these veterans, they all get, you know, for the service, they get guns, they get bullets, they get money, and they're told to go to California. You know, they get land, and they get land, they get bounty land. And so it hastens the, not only the settlement, but the idea that Western expansion is an ongoing war. A war of extermination and extirpation.
Well, wars of extermination and extirpation are always nice places to end. Greg, thank you so much. Next time,
we end on them quite a bit, actually.
It turns out the history of U.S. foreign policy oftentimes touches on those. So next time we'll go from the Civil War down into the present. Just want to say thank you so much for really taking the time to dig in a really serious way. And I'll have you know, I won't reveal their name, but I was at a conference recently and someone said, thank God for American prestige. It's the best gift to a grad student. Because you get all these professors talking about their books. Yeah, well, for the podcast, because they're like, all these scholars are talking about their books, so it helps apparently for comps. So we're doing God's work here. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Greg. Thank you, Derek. And we'll see you again soon.
And pick up the book.
Yes, pick up the book, of course.
America.